Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and him, Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. And I have to say, Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire, that me, Kevin Day, is slightly jealous of Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire because you're going somewhere nice tomorrow, aren't you?
Yes, I've been asked to attend the World Football Summit in Seville for a few days, which is absolutely fantastic. And that coincides with the Rangers versus Eintracht Frankfurt Europa League final. And when I was offered the opportunity to go there, I applied to UEFA in the ballot to see a ticket, because at that time we didn't know who was going to be in the final. So I've got a tier one ticket, which is right on the halfway line, I think. Wow. So it should be a hoot. And if anybody asks my name there, my name's Billy McPherson.
Shame on you, Kieran, with your Irish. It's questions day, Kieran. And the first question comes from me, and it is, why is things like the World Football Summit always held in beautiful places like Seville?
The last one I went to was Madrid. They are fantastic.
Yeah, there are hotels and conference facilities in Croydon, you know, Kieran, and it is in the world. We have some very good questions today, some of which are the final questions that we didn't get around to asking at the live show in Accrington. And the first question, though, comes from Tom Haywood. And Tom says, fan-made football kit concepts found all over Twitter around annual official kit release dates and all over bits of paper around my living room are arguably better than the real thing. Mine are definitely better than the real thing. Modern kit designers, notably Puma, are pumping out the same kit designs for different teams. And I often wonder why this is. And do they still spend a lot of money to have these generic kits designed? Surely they could round up the best fan concept each year and conduct an online poll to ascertain a winner. That would be very democratic, Tom, wouldn't it? It would be favoured by fans and would save a lot of money than companies such as Nike spend on kit designers. Are generic kit designs some kind of marketing ploy? Kits are something, Kieran Nutt, most football fans, including us, are obsessed with. So I would say 20% of our questions since the pod started have been about kits.
Yes. And again, thank you to the people that gave us some kits last week. I have worn my Berwick Rangers kit already, and I was just made up. It sort of, when you put on a football kit for the first time, it does transport you to another land, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it does, Kieran, and it's a lovely black and amber striped kit. But I always get slightly worried about wearing another team's kit, because I just know that if I step outside, some Palace fan that I'm aware of will drive past in a car. And it will be all over Twitter that I've been wearing a Berwick Rangers kit. As indeed, a very good friend of mine called Neil the Fish. Let's not go into why he's called Neil the Fish.
No, let's.
Several seasons ago, as the result of losing a bet for charity, he was required to wear a Brighton shirt to our last game of the season against Fulham. And he can be an angry man. He's delightful. We all love him to bits, but he can be. And he had it on for about 15 seconds before getting really, really angry. So I'm slightly. I love football kits, but I'm always slightly wary of wearing another team's one. But anyway, to Tom's question.
From a manufacturing point of view, there are three elements to producing any product. Yeah, it could be a football kit, could be a car, could be a microphone, could be a watch, doesn't matter what it is. You look at materials, labour, and overheads cost. And when it comes to football kits, the manufacturers are looking at production runs. So, yeah, we all know that the kits are manufactured mainly in Asia. And what they want to do is to minimise the costs during that production run. So if all you have to do is to change the colorways of the yarns, it's a lot easier than having to go and put in a completely new design and take that off, take it off the plant and machinery and then put on something else. So It works out cheaper from a production run perspective as far as the clubs are concerned. I agree entirely. I look at those kits that are all over social media. I go, God, they're absolutely fantastic. But the next year's kit normally is designed about 8 or 9 months before the start of the season. So there is a very, very long lead time. We've already seen some of the kits come out for next season. You know, Liverpool have announced theirs. We've seen this new Newcastle United away kit, which appears to resemble the Saudi Arabian national shirt, which I think is not going to go down necessarily well with some of the critics. So from the manufacturer's point of view, there are some clubs who are supplied by the likes of Adidas, Nike, and Puma, and so on, who probably don't justify from a cost point of view having a wholly specifically designed kit for them, because they might be selling 2,000 of those shirts. So therefore, they say for 22-23, this is our generic design, and they'll call it, you know, the Vapor or the Flyway or whatever it's going to be. And what we're going to do is we'll stick your badge on and your sponsor name, and that's what you get. Simply because if you are Southend, if you are Mansfield, you are not selling enough units to have a bespoke piece of merchandise. From the manufacturer's point of view, and remember, the clubs want to make money as well. So we effectively go back to the sort of the position of Henry Ford and the Model T Ford on the Model T. You can have this in every color provided it's black. Well, you know, Nike or Adidas will say you can have any kit you want provided it's our generic design. If you want something more bespoke, it's going to cost you a lot more money, and fans are going to be up in arms. When it comes to the big kits, because Manchester United sell so many units, then Adidas are quite happy to give them a specific bespoke design for the home kit, the away kit, the third kit, and so on. So that's where we are. It simply comes down to a cost issue. It's cheaper to do the generic kits. It would be great. I mean, if anybody who's working for a kit manufacturer wants to get in contact with us and come on the show, we would love to have you on, because we are fans of football kits. But to actually talk us through the process, you know, I've spoken to one or two people. So if anybody from those companies wants to come along, you know, just drop us a line. Kieran at priceoffootball.com, and we'll gladly get you on the show to teach us a bit more.
Kieran, it's normally me that has the problems with short-term memory, but not 4 weeks ago, we had a Zoom meeting with some kit manufacturers, remember?
Oh, we did.
Perhaps we could ask them, yes. The ones we already know. They seem like nice people.
Yes.
I'll tell you one thing we do have to put a stop to in terms of kits. It's getting worse every year. The kit announcement is it's the new player announcement, isn't it? It's like a bloody baby gender reveal now. So everyone's getting really excited about it. It's like it's going to be red. It's Liverpool. We know that. Just stop making such a fuss. There's only so much dry ice to go around in the world. Our next question comes from Benjamin Toast, who's been a loyal listener since the very start of the pod, and has asked many questions, so many, in fact, that I've run out of jokes about his name, which I'm sure he's delighted about. But Benjamin Toast says, if I picked up a club for £1 and wanted to wipe the debt out without paying, would putting it into administration and then buying it again for a song do the trick? Or is liquidation the only way to get rid of the debt fully? I don't mind the points deduction that comes with administration, says Benjamin, and I've got the pound.
This is an interesting one. If he did that, if he puts the club into administration, then the administrators have a legal obligation to do what is best for the creditors of the club.
Yeah.
Now, you can have what is known as a pre-pack, where you effectively put a company into administration and you've already had a nudge-nudge, wink-wink arrangement with the administrators that you're going to buy it back at an agreed fee. I'm not saying that the administrators or you are necessarily wrong-uns. Yeah. But it doesn't generate universal approval. I'll say no more than that. So under those circumstances, when you buy the club back from the administrators, you are buying only the assets and none of the liabilities. So that would mean that in going into administration, you would have an immediate 12-point deduction. And coming out of administration, you would have a further 15-point deduction unless you pay 25% of what is owed to the unsecured creditors immediately or commit yourself to paying 35% over 3 years. So if you're not going to commit yourself to that, then potentially that would be okay. However, this is where the EFL, the Premier League, and or the independent regulator, should one be created, this is where they would scrutinise the deal. And you know, they might say, well, this is stiffing the unsecured creditors, and we are therefore not sure that you would satisfy the owners and directors test. The danger is, of course, you say, well, I've got the money to do it because, hey, I'm not paying the creditors, so therefore yeah. I can evidence the money. And this is where, you know, either we need a beefed up owners and directors test, or we need the independent regulator who can act on behalf for the benefit of all stakeholders, including fans, very much it was the fan-led review, but also unsecured creditors. Because you know, we've mentioned it on more than one occasion, football clubs tend to get quite good credit from local suppliers yeah. because often that the person that's running that business will happen to be a fan of the club, of the town or city in which we're involved, and they say, well, under normal circumstances, I'd be pushing you for the money a little bit earlier, but hey, I've supported the club since I was seven, or my nan or my dad or my brother's a huge fan, and therefore I'll give you a bit more slack. And they end up getting into a worse position and losing more money.
Two things, Kieran. Is this something that's standard practice in other businesses? And was the reason that points deductions were introduced in the first place because it was happening in football?
Yes, pre-packs have existed. Again, you are subject to scrutiny. You could be, as the administrator, you could be subject to a complaint to your professional organisation, and therefore you run the risk of professional sanctions. So it does happen in other industries as well. With regards to the points penalties, if you go back to the early 2000s, we went through a period of rapid and frequent insolvencies involving football clubs. The collapse of ITV Digital didn't help,
yeah.
But also owners gaming the system didn't help either. They realised that they could sell the club, buy it back, and all of the unsecured creditors had to effectively sing. There was a view that clubs would wait until quite long into the season,
yeah.
make sure that they weren't going to go down, or they'd work out this, that, and the other, and they put the club into administration. There was one club famously, and the rules have been finessed over a period of time, and rightly so. There was one club that was relegated. With I think two matches to go, and therefore it put itself into administration and said, "Right, we'll take that 12-point penalty now."
Yeah.
The rules have become a little bit better, which is one of the reasons why we are seeing less clubs going into administration. And remember also that if you want to pass the owners and directors test, if you've been involved in a football club which has had two or more administrations, then that would make it very difficult for you to be an owner again.
Mm. We've got a couple of questions left over from the live show. In Accrington, Kieran, and leftover implies that we didn't want to ask them. That's simply not the case. We ran out of time, unfortunately. The first one comes from Chris, and Chris says, how do clubs organise travel costs? Is there a central system that clubs pay into, or are they phoning the local B&B? Also, how do costs differ between leagues?
Right, it does very much differ depending upon which club you are. So, I've got family who are the travel managers or the travel manager for a very high profile club,
indeed,
very well known club, indeed. The job is full time because what do you have to do, especially if that club is involved in pre-season tours or playing in Europe? You are doing constant reconnaissance. What you don't want to do is to end up in a hotel, which is morning, Finlay. What you don't want to do is to end up in a hotel, which the facilities are poor. It's in a noisy area of town. It's actually difficult to gain access to the stadium. You know, you don't want to be stuck in traffic. So what will happen is the travel manager will do a reconnaissance, especially for the overseas trips, to make sure that the standards to which the players are expecting will be met. They'll agree a fee with the hotel. Now, if you are a club in the lower leagues, the chances are that you're not going to be your travel plans are going to involve either coaches or trains, and then it's all about striking up a relationship with the local travel company. So there's no central fund as such. Some clubs expect five-star treatment. Some clubs, when they are traveling abroad, will have sort of charter a flight themselves, especially if it's a big trip. I'm aware of I think I'm telling tales out of school here, but when Manchester United, well, this was quite a few years ago, they went on tour to the States, and they just signed two Brazilian players. I think Anderson was one, and there were two Brazilian players, and of course the two lads didn't speak any English. So Sir Alex Ferguson went to Cristiano Ronaldo and says, Cristiano, we'd like you to, could you just sort of help to introduce them to the club and have a chat with them? It's an 8-hour flight. We're doing this trip to the States for pre-season. And I think Nani was the other. And the problem was that they were on a 747, and there were only so many first class seats, and the rest of the players had to slum it in business class. Mm-hmm. And Cristiano Ronaldo said, "I'm Cristiano Ronaldo. I'm a superstar. They're in business. I'm not prepared to go down and slum it." There is very much a pecking order when it comes to footballers in terms of the expectations they have in terms of these things, and it's a tough gig because footballers aren't, I think it's fair to say, they're not the most organized of people. So you hear tales of players turning up without passports, or they're not, and then when it comes to vaccines recently and so on, or they've forgotten to bring things with them. So the job of these transport managers, and I've got to know a few over the years, is a 24/7 one, because even when they're in the hotel, the manager will get a phone call from the player to say, I know one very high profile player that wanted a pair of shoes, and he was such a high profile player that he had to affect it. The travel manager had to organize security for the player because he wanted to go to the local market to buy a pair of shoes. It's complete lunacy, as you would expect.
I remember talking to somebody at a Premier League club whose job it was to look after players on away games, and I said, "How is it?" He said, "It's like keeping kittens in a basket."
Yes.
And if anybody listening to this has ever had any doubts about the integrity of Kieran Maguire, I would like to point out that when he first told me that one of his family members was the travel manager for a high-profile club, I said, "Oh, my God, he must know some gossip." And Kieran said, yes, he does. And I looked at Kieran expectantly, and Kieran said, "Well, I can't share it with you because that would put his job in jeopardy." It's like, okay, but that's absolutely the right thing to do.
But also, we all know what goes on tour stays on tour.
Those were the days, Kieran. Those were the days. Nowadays, what goes on tour, I have to phone Ali up and ask her how to get out of it, basically. Steve Rawlingson was also at the live show in Accrington, and his question is a sort of existential one. But Steve said, how do you think the football industry will develop in the coming years if the fan-led review is adopted in full, as aspects of it seem to be at odds with the changes being made by UEFA?
Yes, I think... If it is adopted in full and we address financial issues, owners and directors issues, we have a regulator, the idea of shadow boards, golden shares, increased emphasis on the women's game and player welfare. If these are introduced, I think the main issue in terms of UEFA is that UEFA wants to represent the best interests of club owners to a large extent, and the changes by the fan-led review will make the importance of football fans as stakeholders in the game more of a central point. So I think there could be some conflict, but ultimately I think if the industry does get its house slightly more in order, and we're not talking about, you know, nobody wants nationalisation of the game or you know, government interference, micromanaging football, as are some of the claims which are coming out by lobbyists I've seen this lobby company. They've never been involved in football before. Why have they suddenly started caring about our national game? I wonder who's paying them. I think it's just a case of turning the dial down a wee bit, and there's no reason why all the parties can't get on, both domestically and UEFA. I want English football to be a success, you know, and I think you do as well, because our clubs benefit, the bigger clubs benefit, the intimation that's coming out that if the fan-led review proposals are adopted, then English clubs will struggle in Europe. There's no evidence to back that up, because the financial advantage that they already have, would preclude that. So I think as far as Steve is concerned, the two parties can probably coexist with a regulator, with greater emphasis on the input of football fans, while still ensuring that we can compete in Europe and with our European colleagues.
Yeah, we've had occasion this season, particularly, Kieran, to take issue with Chris Sutton on his phone-in show on 5 Live about several things, but his campaign for improved player welfare is exemplary, especially when it comes to head injuries, concussion, illness, etc. Although he's also now obsessed with bee welfare as well, which is interesting. Somebody mentioned artificial grass 2 weeks ago, and he just went off on that about. And he's quite right about the bees. I care a little bit more about the players than the bees, but before I get angry tweets, I care a lot about the bees. I fully understand their importance in the ecosystem of the world. I wasn't expecting to have to apologise for the attitude of bees on the pod this morning. Our next question from the live show at Accrington comes from Michael, who's a Burnley fan. And one of my abiding memories the other night, there's a lot of Burnley fans here, and Andy Holt taking issue with two of them, asking them why they weren't Accrington fans. And they did that panicky thing of going, we go to a lot of Accrington games if Burnley are away. He didn't say that. And then one of them said, hang on a second, I'm from Burnley. But Michael's question is a very interesting one, because we have spoken quite a lot about Burnley and the way they've changed in the past season. And I know a couple of Burnley fans were talking to you individually afterwards about their concerns. And Michael says, Burnley paid small shareholders in cash and vouchers. I have 21 shares, which would be £17,850 worth of club shop vouchers. Is this a way of ensuring they do not have to buy out all the minority shares? And is it ethical not to offer us cash like they paid the larger shareholders? It's a very interesting one, Kieran. I mean, to me, a non-expert, that slightly smells of shenanigans.
Yes, yeah. I don't think it paints Burnley in a particularly great... No. I'll roll back on that. It doesn't present ALK, who are the Burnley owners. I mustn't fall into the trap of saying the football club is the owners.
Yes.
Vice versa.
Yeah.
In terms of where we stand here, there is such a thing, and I'm indebted to our good friend Stuart Hatcher, one of our regular listeners, who's also a lawyer. He pointed me in the direction of, and can you imagine this at 7:30 on a Saturday morning? I'm looking at section 979 of the Companies Act 2006 with squeeze out legislation, We've all had a squeeze out in bed at 7:30 in the morning, but not involving the Companies Act 2006.
I was so hoping you weren't going to say it. Yes, all right. Yeah, we're middle-aged men.
Yes, but we've got the minds. We've got the minds of 12-year-olds. Yeah,
we have. That's why we look so young.
and under this, if you acquire normally, I think it's 90%, sometimes it's 95% of the shares of a company, then you do have the option of forcing out other shareholders to buy the shares, and under those circumstances, you've got to offer the same price as was offered to the shares when you made the takeover. But Burnley's owners don't appear to have gone down this route, and if I've misinterpreted this, you know, by all means get in contact, and we will correct ourselves. What Burnley's owners have said, we will offer to buy the shares from you, and I think 6% of Burnley's shares are owned by minority shareholders. But you don't have to take the offer. We're not forcing you to buy it. So they're not actually using a proper squeeze out as such. And this is where I think some people are feeling slightly unhappy, because what they've said is that we will give you a 50-50 split in terms of cash and vouchers. If you take a look at this, in terms of what Michael said, that the price of an individual share is quite expensive. Hmm. So therefore, £17,850. Yeah, we like Club Tat, that's an awful lot of Ashley Barnes duvet covers, to put it mildly, from the club shop. So you can understand why some shareholders might feel aggrieved. But I don't think that they can get around this, because the majority shareholders are not obliged to buy them out, and they are saying this is what we consider to be a fair offer. It's the same as we've effectively paid for our shares, but in terms of the way that we're offering the offer, by splitting it between cash and vouchers, does seem harsh. I think Burnley Supporters Association, they've said they don't want to sell their shares on principle, because they still want to have a voice at the club's AGM. But if I was Michael, I can understand his sense of annoyance and frustration.
If I was Michael, I'd be bloody furious. I mean, if Stuart is listening, I know Stuart Hatcher is listening, but if Stuart or any other lawyer would like to get in touch and clarify this for us, because that, again, as you know, Kieran, it's why I host this thing. This is not a world I know anything about. Well, that seems inherently unfair that the wealthier shareholders are offered money, and people like, because that's a lot of money. I mean, if you were talking about somebody who owns three shares that they have framed in their toilet and they're being offered 5p or whatever, I could understand that. But this is £17,850.
Yes.
That's a substantial amount of money that he's entitled to get, I would have thought. So I would be really interested to hear from any of our legal friends. Obviously, we haven't got the money to pay you, but you will get mentioned on the pod, which is as good as cash.
It's better than gold.
It's a sort of cryptocurrency in its own right. It's worth 8 Maguires. that's what we're calling our new cryptocurrency, the Maguire.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Sunderland are potentially on the verge of returning to the Championship, which will be very good news for Jack McDonald. And Jack McDonald has asked our next question. And he says, in the last year or so, my club, Sunderland, changed ownership again. My question is, we had a loan of nearly £10 million from MSD, I believe, prior to the takeover. But I haven't seen anything to say that the money was paid back on the takeover being completed. Also, if you'll allow a second question, we will. As a club with a large fan base, we have a good revenue base, particularly for the level we're at. What is the disparity in finances between ourselves and some of the other teams in the league?
Right. So I'll answer these questions in turn. I think it's fair to say that the ownership structure under the previous previous people in charge at Sunderland was not the easiest or the most transparent. Sunderland Association Football Club was owned by Sunderland Limited, the biggest shareholders in Sunderland. Sunderland Limited was a company called Madrox Partners, which is Stuart McDonald's company and Charlie Methven's, and so on. And it was Madrox Partners who borrowed money from MSD, except it wasn't MSD. It was a company set up in the United States called Sunderland FFP. So, yeah, we've got this long trail, this long crumb trail to dig out. Now, from looking at the documentation on Companies House, and it's a glorious sunny day on Saturday morning, and I am looking at the Company's House details of Madrox Partners, and the Baroness said, "You're going to miss out on getting a tan this year, Kieran." And I'm under pressure.
Kieran, you could compromise and read the Company's House stuff outside.
I know there's screen burn, man.
Don't ever say screen burn man again, Kieran, will you? Remember our discussion about being middle-aged men?
Yes, that's true. Yes, I'm not on Miami Vice. but it turns out that having gone into the small print in respect of Madrox Partners, Madrox Partners satisfied the loan due to Sunderland FFP / MSD in October 2021. So you won't see this in the Sunderland accounts, because the way that the deal was organised, that Sunderland itself didn't effectively borrow the money. It was MSD borrowed the money from, sorry, Madrox Partners who borrowed the money from Michael, one of Michael Dell's vehicles. And that money was then repaid when Madrox Partners sold some of their shares to Kirill Louis-Dreyfus. Where did Madrox Partners get its money from? Well, you know, it was the owners of Sunderland, so it was able to utilise Sunderland for that vehicle.
Right.
And if we move on to Jack's second question, I've crunched the numbers. When Sunderland were first in League One, which was season 2018-2019, they were in receipt of parachute payments that year. And I've never seen this extent before, but Sunderland, which was one of 24 clubs in League One, generated 31% of the total income in League One that season. So practically they got a third of the money. And under Stuart Donald's ownership, they didn't get back to the Championship. If we fast forward to 2021, which was, remember, was a season in which the club was playing football under the restrictions of COVID and lockdown, Sunderland's income was £11 million, and that was probably about two and a half times the average of clubs in that division. It would have been far higher because Sunderland get amazing attendances regardless of the division. So for 2022, I'd expect their income to be 3 to 4 times that of the average in the division.
Wow. So we've discussed this before, Kieran. For some of the smaller clubs in that division, Sunderland will be a big loss, won't they?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, yeah, we were chatting to Andy Holt on Tuesday night, and you know, he's absolutely delighted that clubs like Sunderland are in that division, because they sell out Accrington Stanley's magnificent Wham Stadium, and it, we're not saying this because we're fans of Andy. It is what they've done, the money they've spent there, the way that they've developed the club on an ongoing basis is magnificent.
Yeah. Also, how can you not like a man who quite cheerfully unlocked their trophy cabinet to allow people there to have photographs of themselves with the League Two Championship trophy?
Exactly.
Yeah, yes. Even the Burnley fans. we have one more question from Accrington, and we've rather cleverly kept it till after this Sunderland question, because this is a question from Dave Jessup. And Dave says, why do so many clubs borrow from MSD, etc., at high rates of interest? Surely there's a more sustainable channel for clubs to borrow money. And it might be worth reminding people, Kieran, who MSD are at this stage.
Yes. MSD Holdings is what I would call a boutique lender. And they are part owned by Michael Dell, the very successful computer guy. Yeah, we all used to have Dell computers back 20 years ago. They lend money to the sports world, especially football clubs. So Sunderland, Southampton, Derby, quite a few clubs have been involved here. And they charge interest. I think at Southampton they're charging 9.14%. At Derby it's LIBOR, and LIBOR stands for the London Interbank Official Rate. It's what banks lend to each other, plus 8%. So that effectively these days it would be around about nine and a bit. So you know, people say, well, hold on, you know, I can get a mortgage for 3% from a building society or a bank. So why am I paying so much more if I'm a football club? And it comes down to first of all the issues of supply and demand. You know, we've said on quite a few occasions that commercial banks will not lend to football clubs. So you know, Barclays, HSBC, Lloyds, and co. They're not keen on giving standard loans to football clubs because they see them as being risky. Mm. If a club gets relegated, then it could lose a substantial element of its income stream. So how's it going to repay the bank? And also, if our local garage doesn't repay the loan from a bank, if the local widget manufacturer or hotel can't do that, then the banks will put those companies into administration, then encourage them to do so, and that's how they recover their money from the sale of the assets, and that's fine. With a football club, and I can say this with personal experience, the last thing you want to do if you're a bank manager is to put the local football club into administration.
Yeah, of course.
Because you're going to upset an awful lot of your customers. I was once involved in an investigation into a pretty well-known club which had been in the Premier League, which was no longer in the Premier League. And I know I've told this story before, but when it did an investigation, I said to the bank manager, yeah, we've got an issue here. Unless the club really does cut back, under normal circumstances, I'd be advising administration, because I don't see from these cash flow projections how you're going to get repaid. And he says, can we just have a meeting about this? And instead of a meeting in his offices, we had a meeting in a pub. Oh. And he says, "Yeah, I don't want this to be. I don't want this to be minuted as such." Right. My kids go to school in this town.
Yeah.
You know, if their dad is seen as public enemy number one, they're going to get bullied. We're going to have to move out of town. Yeah, I support this club. I've got family to support this club. What can we do? And we came up with a solution whereby, we effectively said to the club, you either do X, Y, or Z, or You're to say that you're in the Last Chance Saloon is you're getting an extra, round in the Last Chance Saloon. And to be fair to the club, I think it realised the severity of the situation, but they were given leeway that would not be given to other industries because of this unique place that football holds in modern society. If I was a bank manager, I'd just say, well, just don't lend them the money. And that is, that's now come on from on high. Don't lend money to companies in what are high risk industries. And football is high risk. So therefore, because the supply of lenders is lower, economics 101, you restrict supply, you put up the price. So what is an interest rate? An interest rate is the price of money. Because you have to now go to boutique lenders, they say, well, Barclays won't lend to you, NatWest won't lend to you, blah, blah, blah won't lend to you. We will, but we're taking on that risk as well. So therefore, as we are taking on extra risk, we're going to charge you a higher rate of interest. So it's simply a function of the perception of risk of the football industry by the lending industry. If we contrast that with the likes of Spurs and Manchester United, who have borrowed from big investment banks at 2-3%, let's be honest, a bad season for Manchester United, is finishing 6th or 7th in the Premier League. They ain't going to be relegated. Yeah. Neither are Spurs. Yeah, yeah. And I know we've had this discussion that club owners in an ideal world want a Premier League in which relegation can't take place. Well, actually, for those, for the big six, they're already there because of the financial advantages that they have. And therefore, we find that the banks are willing to lend to them at lower rates because the biggest hit to a football club is the step down in revenues when you get relegated. That's not going to happen to United or Spurs, so therefore they can borrow at 2 or 3%.
So to answer Dave's point about a more sustainable channel, we're unlikely then ever to see a sort of eco bank or a green bank or a co-op type bank setting up to lend money to football clubs then.
There's that. I mean, one thing which has been considered is for the Premier League or the EFL to say, well, collectively, we are still earning the same amount of money. Yeah, so it doesn't matter which 20 clubs are in the Premier League. There always will be 20 clubs in the Premier League. So could the Premier League or the EFL go to a lender and say, we're effectively a bit like a credit union. We can therefore raise money at cheaper rates and we can pass on those savings to the members. That conceptually could work. Whether there's an appetite for it, I don't know, because remember, we do have some clubs where the owners are quite happy themselves to lend to the clubs at 0%. So they'll say, well, why should we effectively guarantee other clubs borrowing money who can save themselves? They can borrow it now at 5 or 6 instead of 9% when, I'm prepared to put as much money in as possible. Abramovich, what's in it for him? Mansour at City. Why get involved in something which will involve cost savings for other football clubs? Because those other football clubs ultimately are your competitors.
Yeah. And one more thing, Kieran, you mentioned that the interest rates were slightly different for the MSD loans to Southampton and to Derby. Why is that? Do they not have a standard interest rate, MSD, for lending money?
Well, it depends when you take out the loan. Market perceptions change all the time. They'll be different because Southampton is a Premier League football club, and Derby was a Championship club. There's the amount of money being borrowed as well. The more money you borrow, the greater the risk. So therefore, potentially the greater the interest rate.
Now, our penultimate question, Kieran, comes from Tim Delaney in Australia. Is that Finley coming back or going out?
That's Finley saying, he's clearly got an issue with Australians.
He's got a lot of issues, that dog, isn't he, with various countries in the world. There's a lot of detail in this question, Kieran, but it's worth it. So, and Tim Delaney is not particularly happy, I would say. Tim says, one of my three sons plays football in a so-called elite club league in Australia called the National Premier League, NPL. Despite the national in the title, his team never plays outside our state, Victoria. Clubs in this league select about 20 players in each age group, and parents pay the equivalent of £1,500 per season.
Jesus.
Poorer children, including some very talented migrant and refugee kids, play community football instead. Now, the NPL clubs have okay facilities and okay coaching, but they never seem to be able to sell, in inverted commas, any of these elite, in inverted commas, players. Instead, the players just get picked up by scouts in the off-season. My questions are, how does this price for football development, £1,500, compare with other countries, Europe and the UK, for example? And how might football development be funded differently so that talented poor kids in developed countries like Australia can make it to professional leagues?
Wow. I mean, this is really intriguing stuff.
It is, isn't
I mean,
it?
As far as Europe and certainly the UK is concerned, to my knowledge, there's no such thing from the club's point of view, because clubs want to recruit as many talented players as possible, and to put a financial barrier for parents, especially parents who might not have the financial resources, is cutting off your nose to spite your face, because you're potentially losing out on talent. So the focus here is the opposite. We're fully aware of inducements which are given by some clubs, rather than making people pay, and that's the same in Europe. As far as football development being funded differently, I think this is more of an issue in the sense that in Australia, football is competing for interest with other sports. We know that Aussie rules is very popular. We know that rugby is popular as well. And therefore, I think what the clubs are, these elite clubs are trying to do is that they're trying to push themselves as development vehicles to parents. Frankly, Tim, I wouldn't pay it. I'd go and play for one of these community clubs. If your son is good enough and he's playing for a community club, he will be spotted. Because that's where all the scouts go, that's where all the agents go, that's where all of the clubs will ultimately be looking. But I think this is actually a function of football not being as lucrative in Australia as it is potentially in Europe and certainly here in the UK. And therefore, the financial benefits of developing players here is so much more that clubs think it's worth their time to effectively offer the facilities for free. And again, I know somebody that was involved in sort of youth development, and we've got some parents asking for assistance in getting their kids to training financially, which the clubs aren't supposed to do that, but you can arrange taxis and so on.
Yeah, cool.
And if that kid's less good enough, then what's the problem with two taxis a week? If that person's going to be the next Mason Mount or Trent Alexander or Phil Foden, then it's a no brainer to go along with that.
Yeah, I'd be if anybody from the NPL is listening to this, and we know football authorities all over the world do listen to us, I'd be interested to hear what they have to say, because I mean that's just really is pricing youngsters out of football, isn't it? And you say there are people here who wouldn't be able to afford that. Most people here wouldn't be able to afford that, and especially from we know traditionally young players are coming from disadvantaged backgrounds, so we would lose so many youngsters if the parents were being forced to pay. So I would be interested to hear if there is another side to that story, because I find it slightly disturbing. Now, our final question comes from Luke Zubina, And Luke says, Kieran answered a question on the pod a few months ago about front-of-shirt sponsors for international teams, saying that FIFA don't allow international teams to have front-of-shirt sponsors in order to protect their own marketing interests. If this is the case, and it is, how come FIFA allow international teams to choose their own kit manufacturers? England have Nike, for example. After all, FIFA have a long-standing relationship with Adidas, so it seems odd that they would then allow teams to choose different companies to be a kit manufacturer.
Yep. Yeah. Fair comment, Luke.
Yeah.
I think the issue here is that Adidas are FIFA's global partner. So that means that when it comes to perimeter advertising, when it comes to some of the halftime thing, when the shows break, Adidas have potentially some form of priority over what can be seen within the stadium. Itself. FIFA isn't in a position to dictate to individual football associations how they sell their rights for kit manufacturing. So, the likes of, we think about some of the great Italian kits made by the likes of Lotto and Kappa. Yes. And so on. I don't know why. Why do Italian football kits always look so damn good? It's just
it's because they've got Italians in them.
That's possibly something to do with
for the main part. If it was Marie and me parading down Croydon High Street wearing it, people wouldn't be going, oh, that's a sexy kit.
True. Although it has to be said, the Baroness seemed very taken with the Ramsbottom goalkeeper.
She
on
was
Tuesday night.
Yeah, my cousin. She was very taken with him, but he is an exceptionally handsome young man.
Yes.
And also very quiet, which people mistake for being deeply, deeply fascinating. He is deeply fascinating, but he's just quite quiet, especially around predatory older ladies. The Baroness isn't listening to this, is she? No.
I only see Kevin Day claims Baroness to be a cougar. headlines in the Ramsbottom Gazette.
I'm not entirely sure how we got here, Kieran, but should we get back to the kits?
Right, but it's simply because the National Football Association has the responsibility for generating their own revenues, and they are independent of FIFA. So FIFA has the rights to have its senior commercial partners, but it's a commercial partner rather than a kit manufacturing partner deal that they have with Adidas. And because the two are independent of each other, that's why individual countries have separate deals with their manufacturers.
Mm. Now, before we go, Kieran, it's just occurred to me that some of our listeners may be worried that, what with you being in Spain and going to the Europa Cup final, we might not be able to record next week. But don't worry, everybody, we have made plans. We're going to record on Tuesday night, and we've worked out a system. Kieran will be on the balcony of a hotel in Seville, and I shall be in a garage in Norbury. it's not an issue. It's not a problem. Thanks to everyone who's donated to the pod via our Patreon page. It's very kind of you. And if you'd like to make a small monthly contribution yourself to our Always 3 to AirPod, go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. I nearly said comfortably then, didn't I? So if you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. And prior to him going off to Gatwick, before he goes to Seville, I shall leave you in the capable hands of Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, as always, folks, thanks so much. And we've been trying to come up with a way of showing a bit of appreciation to everybody that's supported the show via Patreon. And this is probably if you think, well, I wonder, is it going to be a signed book? Is it going to be a football shirt? What I'm going to do is that I'm going to offer a prize, and the prize is 2 tickets to see Aha play at the arena in Wembley. It's been an absolutely fantastic gig. There is a backstory to this. The Baroness's daughter is getting married in 2 weeks' time, and this gig is taking place the night before. And the Baroness has said, I need time to prepare, which I don't understand. So
What I'd like to do, as to show a bit of thanks back, is two tickets to see A-ha, who are an absolutely brilliant band, in London on Friday the 27th of May. And if you are interested, you know, we'll put your names into a draw. So anybody that, that is a Patreon of the podcast, if you want to just send an email with your details to prizes@priceoffootball.com, and I'm going to ask a question, a test question. According to A-ha, the sun always shines where? Okay, so that, hopefully that won't filter out too many of you. We'll do the draw next week, and say Friday the 27th of May. There'll be a backup prize for somebody else. On the grounds that I've still got some books in my bookshelf which are unsigned, so I'll do another prize as well. Just out, yeah, we're at the end of the football season. We're both feeling pretty good about our teams this season, so it's a way of showing a bit of appreciation back to you for supporting us. And if you don't want to use Patreon, and you know, we fully appreciate that, you know, times are tough for everybody. If you want to show the show a bit of love, the way that you can do that is going onto your podcast app and giving us a review, giving us 5 stars if you think we deserve it. If you don't, you know, absolutely don't. If you want to write something as well, it doesn't matter what you write. You could say you would rather have the show presented by Ben Elton and Elton John, and I think that'd be quite a good listen. A little bit of politics thrown in, perhaps. Apart from that, take care, look after yourselves. And any Rangers fans who come up to me and say, are you Kieran Maguire on Wednesday? My reply will be, my name's Billy McPherson.
Yes. Elton John once called me a four-letter word, beginning with C. Yeah, he did. I will share those details on a later pod. people, we often talk to people who do podcasts, other people who do other podcasts, and occasionally they say to us, "What do your Patreons get extra then for their money?" And we sheepishly reply, "Nothing. They just get their name read out." But now I can look them in the eye and say, "Two tickets to A-ha at Wembley Arena." Bye, everybody. Bye.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.